We talk a lot on this podcast about chess improvement, but when it comes to improving your hiring processes, Indeed is the platform you need. Indeed has over 350 million global monthly visitors, and it has a matching engine that helps you find quality work candidates fast. You can use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with your candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree that Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Years ago, when I was running a chess teaching business, I found it hard to find good help, and I had to go through a lot of back and forth to even screen potential candidates. Indeed allows you to do those things efficiently in one place. Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed for hiring, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of Perpetual Chess will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility if you go to Indeed.com/chess. Just go to Indeed.com/chess right now, and you'll be supporting our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast, Indeed.com/chess. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, everyone. I am Ben Johnson, and this is the Perpetual Chess Podcast. Perpetual Chess is a weekly interview show where top chess players, authors, content creators, and accomplished amateurs discuss their careers and share stories and chess improvement tips. Perpetual Chess is a part of the Blue Wire Podcast Network, and we'd like to give special thanks to our presenting chess education sponsor, Chessable.com. For more information about the show, you can go to PerpetualChessPod.com. But without further ado, let's get to the show. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Perpetual Chess. We are joined this week by someone I have been reading periodically for over a decade. He is one of the original chess bloggers in my mind, a FIDE master, a chess trainer. He's been blogging about chess since 2005. He's a state champion of multiple states, Indiana and Nevada, peak USCF rating over 2,400. He has made many videos for chesslectures.com, coached a Scholastic National Championship winning team, and when he is not doing chess training, he has taught philosophy for over a decade at different universities. He's currently working at Ashland University, doing both chess and non-chess activities, but of course, we're here to talk mostly about chess, so let's welcome to the show FIDE Master Dennis Monacrucis. Welcome, Dennis.
Thanks, and I do want to make one minor correction. It's chesslecture.com.
Chess lecture. There's only one lecture, yeah, not multiple.
That's right. Yeah, it's all part of the Borg or something like that. That's right.
Okay. My apologies for that. Well, Dennis, I'm excited to finally speak with you. As I mentioned, I've been reading your blog for years, and I'm sort of blogging in terms of the Linkfest that I'm doing, which we'll talk more about later. But since you've been blogging since 2005, I thought that might be a fun moment to start at. If you could describe, obviously I have some knowledge of this, but you could describe what was going on in the chess world at 2005 and what prompted you to start one of the most thankless jobs of all of the thankless jobs in the chess world, blogging about chess.
Right. Well, first of all, thanks for having me. So I really appreciate the chance to spend some time with you. And what you're doing is fantastic. So it filled a void in the chess world and a really cool one at that. So good job by you. So back in 2005, I think Paul Morphy had just retired from chess. No way, it's not that far yet.
Right.
But speaking of retirements, Kasparov retired, I think, within a few weeks of when I started the blog. And the reason why I started it was, as you said, I'm one of the first, and there really wasn't much going on back then. So just as a chess fan, I would watch these big events. I think it was maybe Vicon Zay of that year, or maybe Linares is when I started blogging. And I would always find, so I'd watch the games online, and then when it was over, it was sort of like, okay, that's over. The reports on the website, so there was chessbase.com, which is still exists, but it's kind of been eclipsed by some other sites. And that was almost all there was. And so, you know, like, think about your favorite sports, right? So you many sports fans, maybe not you, I don't know, but possibly you, so like to watch the pregame, and we get kind of psyched up for it. And then after, there's highlights, and there's interviews, and there's all this stuff that you kind of bask in like the after show. And there was very little of that. And for such a rich game, there really wasn't that much that was, let's say, entertaining and educational. I mean, you could buy videos, you could buy instructional videos, but in terms of just some place where you can kind of hang out and see what's the latest news and chat about it, there wasn't all that much. So after kind of wishing that this was there for, I don't know, being aware of wishing that this was there for a year or two, I thought, well, why don't I just start writing about it myself? And that's kind of what propelled it, was just, this is what I wished was there. And so, hey, I'll just do it.
It sounds very familiar. That's basically how Perpetual Chess started.
Right.
You know, sat around waiting for someone else to do it and finally said, okay, I guess it has to be me. Well, but we're glad to see you doing it. And so you mentioned it was near the end of Kasparov's reign. What else was going on? I mean, obviously, you know, I think of things, but it's that era. You know, I think of Toilet Gate, I think
right.
of the disputed world championship, but I don't have the exact timeline down. Like, what are your biggest memories of those early days?
Right. So exactly. So 2005 was when, Kremnik was still the world champion in the linear title. And I think, you know, it was maybe, you know, it was Kazumjanov, I think, was the official FIDE champion at that point. Yeah, it was before.
Yeah,
it was
we should
before
probably explain a little bit
right.
for newer listeners.
Sure. Okay, so I'll give the quick rundown. So,
yeah.
1993, Short qualified to face Kasparov. So, breaking finally this long run of Kasparov-Karpov matches, and Kasparov and Short decided, nuts to FIDE, we're going to take the championship and organize it on our own. And FIDE basically said, okay, goodbye to you, and they took the two people that Short beat in the candidates, which was Karpov and Timman. So Karpov and Timman played their match. Kasparov and Short played their match. And it was split from 1993 until, 2007, when you had the match tournament in Mexico City, which I attended, by the way. So I went with a friend.
I want to hear about that.
Yeah, so that was fun. But anyway, so in this period, there had been a lot of attempts to reunite. I think there was the Prague Agreement, which ended up kind of falling flat. That was an attempt by Sirwan, and it was going to have Ponomariov, who was the FIDE champion at that moment when Sirwan cooked this up. So it's going to be Ponomariov, Kasparov, Kramnik, and I forget who the fourth person was going to be. But they were going to have like some kind of match tournament, a bit like the old 1948 tournament after Lyekin died in The Hague in Moscow, to make it work. But that didn't work out either. And so finally, Kramnik kind of made a deal and said, okay, I'm going to get some extra privileges here. Like, I get this rematch or I get to play a title match after Mexico City if I'm not the winner of it. But basically, it finally got reunited in 2007. And Kasparov, when he quit, part of it was just that he had been hoping Kramnik would give him a rematch just without playing, without having to qualify in any way. And Kramnik said, well, you know, a deal's a deal. This was, you know, not what we agreed to when we set up our match. So no thanks. And so Kasparov got tired of waiting for a Prague style reunification or Kramnik giving him a rematch and just, okay, well, I've been here, done that as far as tournament success is concerned. So I'm done. And then you had, again, this eventual rematch, and that was, of course, Kramnik against Topalov, which was just all, you know, so we've got our scandal now. This was the scandal of that time.
Yeah, as someone who was covering it, of course, it's come up periodically on the podcast. But, so, you know, Dennis, I don't, as we're recording this 11 days before it'll be released in terms of the current scandal,
right,
and the news comes fast and furious.
Sure.
So I don't want to get too much into the scale of this scandal, but if you could just compare it to Toiletgate and maybe give a little context on this this famed controversy in the Topalov-Kramnik World Championship match.
Right. So Toiletgate was, this occurred during that reunification match. And up to that point, Kramnik and Topalov had friendly relations with each other. So they were, I don't know if they were buddies, but I mean, they always got along fine. There was no real problem. Neither player, or both players, I should say, have a good reputation in the chess world. So this was, you know, not the sort of thing where you were expecting, anyone was expecting some kind of fireworks off the chessboard at the time. So I forget how many games in this was now, but well, it started with game two. Yeah, I think that's right. So game two, Kramnik had won game one, and in game two, he was in just all kinds of trouble. Topalov basically missed, okay, it often was referred to as a mate in three. It wasn't mate in three, but it was like mate in three or he wins everything. And Topalov missed that win, and then somehow Kramnik barely escaped and even went on to win the game. And at some point, shortly after that, Topalov's team, led by Silvio Danilov, accused Kramnik that when he would go to his rest area, so the players would have rest areas where there's a bathroom, but also they could just, they had a couch, they could just sit down, look at the game on a screen, and just be away from the board. And Kramnik would often do that. He was kind of pacing his rest area and so on. And Topalov's team just accused Kramnik and said that, okay, he's spending too much time in there, and he's maybe getting moves, and you know, they looked, and there's maybe some cable that's coming in through the, you know, the tiles over the bathroom, and basically more or less accused him of cheating. And anyway, it was a huge scandal. There was never a shred of evidence. There also isn't, let's say, Ken Regan style evidence that Kramnik was cheating either. In other words, you know, matching his moves with computer moves, there didn't seem to be any reason to think that he was getting illicit help. And of course, it made chess the butt, no pun intended, of all sorts of jokes in the popular media as well. You know, Toiletgate kind of lends itself to that sort of thing. So do you want to jump
in? How would you say the popular media? Obviously, it's been quite a firestorm here, this current controversy.
Sure.
And of course, the anal beads, you know,
right,
small subplot really just mentioned on a Twitch stream once. And unfortunately, so much mainstream media has run with that angle of the story.
Yeah, they'll never get to the bottom of it. All right.
Good. Very well played. Yes. So how does this firestorm compare to that one in terms of like media magnitude, Dennis?
It seems like this one, I don't know, I think in general, I think chess has been getting more coverage in recent years. So just in keeping with the broader trend, I think it's probably getting a bit more, but that got a lot. But it also, I think it kind of blew over quickly. So it was more or less the joke of the day or the week, and then it was done. But this one, also because it's going in multiple stages, and who knows, maybe there'll be a third stage. I mean, Carlsen seemed to promise that after this tournament is over, which as of this recording, it'll be between the time we're recording this and the time that it airs, that he's going to say something. So that might ignite a third little explosion in this.
Yeah,
this
both he and chess.com seem like they're going to say something at some point. So, but yeah, we shouldn't speculate about it too much. But yeah, I don't know if you saw today, Dennis, there was an Onion headline, Niemann cheating scandal spirals out of control as Magnus Carlsen's rook found dead. It's really populated the consciousness when not only is it in the Onion, but they're not even offering context. They're just Hans Niemann's name.
Right.
It's just to allow readers to assume they know who this 19-year-old number 40 in the world.
Right. Yeah. I have more mild jokes prepared. Like, you know, in a game that starts d4, knight f6, c4, any move, I'm going to say improving over, you know, Neiman Carlson. Or
your, right. Yeah. Yeah. Which brings us back to the blog, because one thing I've admired about your blog for years is that, you know, you generally take a fairly matter of fact tone, right, and you cover both the events and you annotate the game. So how did you come to, or not always, obviously, right, but how did you come to the decision to do both?
To both cover? Well, because again, that was part of something that was absent when I started. So a lot of these recap sites, it's better now, much better now, although sometimes even now it's kind of just en passant, so to speak. You know, I'd be curious about these games and people weren't analyzing them. So, well, let's dig in and do that too. So the recap, just, you know, who beat whom, okay, that you can find a million places, but I do it just to generally for the sake of completion or completeness. But the game annotations, again, I'm curious, and people, you know, some people can sit and watch the commentators for 5 hours, but most people don't. Generally, I don't. I mean, sometimes I do if I have a really free day, I'll watch for a while. But, you know, you're curious. I mean, these are these great players playing, and it's kind of nice to have some insight. And another thing, too, is that often, even when players are watching, they're watching online and they just see, oh, the engine spikes, these guys are idiots, you know,
right,
or they're geniuses. And, you know, so I try to give some kind of human understanding of what's going on. Even if I'm in a rush and I'm largely relying on what the engine says, I'm still at least trying to translate it into humanese from
yeah,
the engine.
I was wondering how you use the, like how it's evolved in terms of how you use the engine. Obviously the engines have gotten a lot stronger since 2005.
Yeah.
And how you use them these days.
Yeah. So about that. So there was, this is kind of a nice online publication or e-publication called Chess Today that Irish Grandmaster Alexander Van Buren would publish.
Classic.
And it was there for quite some years. And he would have this kind of regular little column where he would say, what computers can't do, or something along those lines. And, you know, kind of laugh, okay, here's some position where it's a complete fortress, but the computer's saying plus 50 or something like that. And so it'd snicker at that, or things that weren't so crazy. And almost all of those now don't exist. they got the positional stuff down, the tactical stuff down, the horizon effect. Well, there's always going to be a horizon effect, I suppose, but it's so far beyond what we're able to expose in general that it's kind of meaningless. And, you know, there's still some positions where they're going to, you know, maybe miss it a little bit, but by and large, they're doing a fine job. So again, I see the point of using the computer is obviously you're doing tactical checks, but it's also, or what you're doing is, again, you're trying to make this understandable for humans. And it's tricky. And I would say that Stockfish, which is clearly the best engine, has kind of made things worse recently with the evaluations.
I had a feeling you're going there. Yeah. The extreme.
Right. So now it's
evaluations.
Like, yeah. So, you know, Stockfish thinks, okay, Black has a weak pawn, I'm going to win in 90 moves, but the evaluation is plus 3. You know,
right.
Exactly.
It just wants you to feel as bad as possible when you don't convert one of those positions.
Right. So, you know, the thing is, like, Leela's evaluations are more realistic, translating it to a human, but again, Stockfish is a lot stronger. And so there's always these trade-offs. But, yeah. So again, though, for spectators who are watching, the Stockfish evaluations are awful because it looks like, you know, a move that, okay, granted, Stockfish versus Stockfish, yes, it can beat its chest and say, I'm going to win every time, but that doesn't translate into a human evaluation at all.
Yeah. And Dennis, I want to pick your brain about Chess Improvement, but one more topic on the sort of blog front. I've actually mentioned on this pod before because I've been reading you for a long time, but up until recently, I at least wasn't aware if there was a way to get it emailed to me. And, you know, I'm like one of these old school blog readers who used to read RSS feeds. So I could just, you know, download everything into my brain, basically. But then when Google Reader went gone, right. From that point forward, and I got more active on like Twitter and other social media, I started to consume things differently. So when you finally moved to this platform, Substack, which is like the, you know, the hot new blogging platform, I guess you could say, I was quite excited because finally I can get it delivered and don't forget to read your blog. So what precipitated your moving to Substack, Dennis?
Well, as you said, it's kind of the hot new thing. So there are a lot of people, a lot of Substack blogs that I look at. And so I was like, at first I thought, well, it was mostly political people. So I thought, okay, this is just some kind of niche thing. But then I saw, no, people are just kind of moving to this thing en masse. And I had also had, so it was partially that, and partially I would have these kind of regular difficulties with the old blogs provider. And at a certain point it was like, okay, it's always a pain in the neck to do something new. But this seems to be a pretty friendly setup. And this old thing is just annoying. So let's make the jump. And what you said too, that this can just be automatically mailed to people. You know, I knew that would be a hit. Because again, it has been for me. So I've been happy to get my info that way as well.
Yeah. And obviously I'm using it for the LinkFest and I'm really impressed with the interface. I mean, I use Squarespace for the Perpetual Chess podcast and it's okay, but it's very, very user friendly and appealing. I'm finding Substack and I use MailChimp. I mean, I don't know how interested listeners are in this, but a lot of people are doing this sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And I find it way better than MailChimp as well.
Right. Yeah. The only thing I wish was a little bit different is comment moderation. So basically all I can do is just delete a comment, period, but I can't like edit it or someone makes a typo or. Like Ken Regan, he responded to my thing, but he had accidentally mistyped his name. And it's like I couldn't fix that, so he had to just create a new account and that sort of thing. But in general, and the old blog was a Squarespace thing. And so I had kind of a lower tier set up there, and yeah, it was just a pain. So yeah, this is much, much, much easier, much smoother. I also like the interface and the look, so... Yep.
Yeah, and we should say the Chess Mind is completely free as of now. And we should talk about the Ken Regan thing because I thought it was pretty cool. You wrote an open letter asking a few questions about how his cheat detection algorithm works, and then boom, there he. I mean, shout out to Ken. He is pretty accessible, but then there he is in the comments.
Right, and we're kind of friends. I mean, so not like close friends, but we're friends. I mean, I've been to his house and. So we've had interactions over the years. I mean, he's been reading the blog for a long time.
So did he say, why didn't you write a closed letter?
He had no problem. So he answered very quickly.
And did you feel like, so this has been coming up a lot, obviously, you know, this week, Fabiano Caruana on his new podcast gave an expansive interview where he pointed out that there might be some, what he considers to be some flaws. I don't know if flaws is the right word, but basically he doesn't think that Ken's algorithm may not be sensitive enough or, you know, and it gets to like, whenever you have a model, you tend to like err on the side of caution.
Right.
So anyway, I mean, I'm curious if you have any thoughts on that, not being a statistician, but also generally the feedback that Ken gave to your questions.
Right. So I'm not a statistician, but I mean, I play one on TV, but I mean, I have some familiarity, so I'm not, definitely not a professional by any stretch of the imagination, but I mean, I'm not math phobic by any means. So I had a former life where I was in STEM a little bit. So, I saw a transcript of, I think, the relevant portions, at least of what Caruana had to say. And I mean, I don't think Ken would deny that there are going to be false negatives. Right. So I don't think he's denying that, I mean, he said it. I mean, that there are certain things that it will catch and other things where, you know, maybe it won't. So the question is how sensitive is it, right? So what's maybe an acceptable percentage and how easy is it to figure out? And that's what I was getting at with that first question that I asked Ken in the open letter, right? I asked, did you have anyone try to see if they could bust your algorithm? And he said, well, we tried early on and that was kind of the end of it. And that's not good. I mean, I think he should, if he can, or, you know, find volunteers where we're trying to bust it and we can send them the data and the players' ratings and so on, and see how it goes. Especially if he's not taking time usage into account, or I guess he is with the online games. Like when it's on chess.com or Lee Chess or Chess24, but not the tournament, the regular FIDE games that are merely being broadcast online, as I understand it. So yeah, no, I think that's clearly something that should be done to try to figure out, you know, how likely is it that someone can beat the system if they're, because again, he's released so much information about how the algorithm works that it's a bit of a stationary target, perhaps.
Yeah, which of course is why chess.com is so secretive, which of course opens them up to criticism. So it's a slippery slope, but yeah, I mean, in a sense, I think it's good to have Ken on the sort of very transparent side. And then, you know, I certainly understand where chess.com is coming from in terms of not being transparent. But as Jakob Aagaard recently said in our interview, it's creating some moral issues in terms of how to deal with cheaters. So, yeah, it's a difficult topic.
Right. I mean, I know they don't say this person cheated. They just merely chase them off the platform and people guess, why are they no longer on there?
Yeah, why did their account close in the middle of that tournament?
That's right.
They never played again.
It's a mystery. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, Dennis, I want to get to some chess improvement talk. Obviously, you've been lecturing about chess for decades and coaching adults and kids alike.
Right.
So, but first, we're going to take a break and hear from our sponsors. Perpetual Chess is proud to be brought to you in part by our presenting chess education sponsors, Chessable.com. Of course, Chessable uses spaced repetition to help you learn opening sequences, tactical patterns, specific end games, whatever it may be that you need to work on your game. Some of their latest courses include Understanding Chess Openings Part 3 by none other than Big Vladdy, former world champion Grandmaster Vladimir Kramnik, sharing his lifetime of expertise on how to respond to various E4 possibilities. So be sure to check that out. And they have a free preview for Chessable Pro members. So please just remember to make it part of your routine to go to Chessable.com and check out all of their new offerings, which are available both for free and for purchase.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
And we are back and we're ready to talk some chess improvement. Dennis, obviously very strong and very well read in the topic of chess. But my first question, Dennis, is our mutual friend Brian Karen of the Chess Book Collectors Facebook group tells me that you were a strong young player, but you quit chess at some point for a period of time.
I did, yes. So I started playing, well, I learned how to play, I think, when I was 8. So this was after the Fischer boom, after Fischer won the title. I would say it's still during the Fischer boom, and started really getting interested around when I was 10. And I didn't play any tournaments until I was 13 because I didn't know tournaments existed, and or that they existed where I was. And so my first rating was, well, I played in 3 tournaments all kind of back to back to back, and I ended up 18-11, which,
wow,
it's pretty good.
Monster.
You know.
Yeah.
But I mean, again, I had been playing for, you know, probably 3 years. I mean, not in tournaments, you know, and no coaching, but playing at a chess club and reading books and, you know, still kind of working on the game on my own as best as I could.
I'm sorry, how old did you say you were?
So 13. You know, nowadays you're a grandmaster by the time you're 13 or you're not that interesting. But back then that was pretty good being 18.
That
11,
was really
13,
good. Yeah.
And so became a master when I was 17 and was still kind of making decent improvement. So I was pretty close to 2400 when I was 22. Like my last, actually already at this point I had given up the game, but like my last tournament that I played in, just because I had promised to the organizer I would play, I beat Elliot Winslow, who was an IM, in like 20 moves, and I drew with Walter Brown when he was still
the legend. Do you have any story to go with it? Time trouble? Or?
Yeah. Well, the funny thing is, you know, so of course he did all the spastic stuff with, you know, where he's just kind of twitching and moving fast and hands go up, hands go down. But, yeah, it wasn't actually that distracting somehow. So I don't know whether it was lucky or bad luck. I don't know, but I played a lot of strange opponents over my time when I was young. I remember there was one player I played in a tournament in Reno where he would just all of a sudden like flap his arms and like slam them against the table. It was just repeatedly, wow. Like the more intense he got, he would start doing it. You know, I would ask him to stop or ask the director to ask him to stop. And he would kind of, oh, sorry. But it would again kind of build up more and more over time. So I think playing this kind of colorful cast of characters over the years, And having heard about Brown being super nervous and all of that, it actually wasn't so bad when I played him. But it was a really interesting game. He was polite. I mean, he didn't say to kind of refer to Neiman again. You know, oh, how could I draw with this idiot? I'm so embarrassed. You know, what, I'm such a loser. You know, nothing like that. And he was perfectly gracious, and it was an interesting game. So. Anyway, I was, you know, up and coming. I nearly qualified for the U.S. Junior three times. So I think, I think at least once I was an alternate, maybe twice. And then the third year, I thought, for sure I've qualified. And it turned out that because of the date for the World Junior, and this is a rule they've changed since then, but I was like 2 days too old. But not 2 days too old for the U.S. Junior, but 2 days too old for the World Junior. So if I won, I would be ineligible. And I was, you know, pleading with the guy, you know, this is something I've been working for years to get into this thing. I said, you know, well, if I win, let the runner up go. You know, I wasn't a favorite anyway, but you know, if I win, let this, no, can't do that. Sorry. That was kind of aggravating. Anyway, so 22. And at this point, my Christian faith had been more and more important to me. And it wasn't that I said, oh, I'm a Christian, I can't play chess. Nothing like that. It was just that I kind of woke up one day and realized that I hadn't played chess in a couple of months, or I hadn't looked at chess in months, and didn't care. So mm-hmm. It was just that it sort of disappeared.
Yeah. And, I mean, sorry, go ahead.
Oh, and, I was, and it kind of stayed disappeared. I did play in, I think, one or two really small tournaments in California when I was going to grad school there, like two or three years later. And that was kind of the end of it. Until New York, so it was just in time to help me blow up my dissertation that I got back into chess. So this was when the Kasparov-Anand match took place. So it was like a first little dip back in the pool in 95. So 88 is when I had stopped, and then I played in these few tournaments. I think in 92 maybe, and then 95 I watched the match. I discovered ICC, which is, you know, again terrible for someone who's supposed to be doing their dissertation research. And I had gotten a couple of papers, philosophy papers, accepted into a grad journal. And the editor said, you know, I'm accepting them, but, you know, there's going to be some minor changes. Give me a call. And I called, and the answering machine picked up instead of him. And it said, this is so-and-so from Chess in the Schools. And, oh, what's this thing? So then I started working with Chess in the Schools, which was great, but again, kind of sidetracked me back into chess, and that's where I kind of started going again. So this is like 97, 98. 97 is when I started working with them.
Okay, and I think we just missed each other at Chess in the Schools. And did you finish your dissertation? Or,
nope.
Yeah, it seems like there's a tradition now in the chess world of maybe philosophy dissertations in particular. I'm thinking of John Hartman from US Chess and JJ Lang, my fellow chess podcaster. Okay. They get into philosophy, and then they don't quite finish.
So I have a couple I have an MA and an MPhil in philosophy, but yeah, the MPhil is basically an all but dissertation degree from Fordham University.
Okay. And I mean, it sounds like obviously once you did get into chess as a teen, it sounds like you climbed up the ranks pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. What do you attribute your success to? Were you a book guy? Were you a just play a ton guy? How did you improve, Dennis?
Right. Yeah. Well, I definitely wasn't a computer guy because they weren't very good back then. Books, definitely. I mean, but I played a ton too. And one thing I think that was kind of helpful. So there was a group of about four or five of us. I think I was the youngest of the bunch, but we were all pretty close in strength. I was generally a little bit ahead of them, but there were occasions where they were a little bit ahead of me. And, you know, it was one of these rising tides lifting all the boats. But where I ended up kind of exceeding them, so like the number two guy out of our group made master briefly a couple of times. And everyone else made it to expert, but didn't make it to master. And I think I did two things that they didn't do. So we all looked at books, but what I did, I think I spent more time on books with books than they did. And the second thing is that I would look at just everybody's games. So my best friend, the guy who ended up number two out of this bunch, was a big Fischer fan. And who wasn't, right? His chess is great. Right. And so he would look at Fischer's games regularly and look at openings and other stuff too. But like I went through every world champion's games that I could get my hands on. So Reinfeld's book of Capablanca's best games and Ilyekin's 2-volume autobiographical work on his games and Bofinick's My 100 Selected Games and so on, just for everybody. Tall's Life and Games. I had at some point I got the red book on Spassky, the old Weltgeschichte.
Ah, Fischer's favorite.
Yeah, yeah. Right, exactly, because Fischer mentioned it. So I finally found it at some point. And it's just basically a database. There's no annotations. It's just games with diagrams after every five moves. But it was convenient back then when there weren't databases, and you know, we didn't have the Moscow Chess Club card file or anything like that. So, but you name it. I had Karpov's. I went through Karpov's Collected Games through 74. That old book, and the Wade and O'Connell book on Fischer, and so on, and Vic Vasiliev's book on Petrosian. So all these books, and I would go through them. It didn't matter if this is my style or what I perceived to be my style or not. Just looking at all of these games gave me a reasonably well-rounded chess education, and also old tournament books, and I mean, I had endgame books and other stuff too, and opening books, of course. But just looking at so many games, and so the advantage that gave me was that I knew more openings, not necessarily well. I mean, certainly not by contemporary standards. I mean, players of my rating now, I think, know much more about the opening than I did back then. But by comparison, I think I was in really good shape. And again, stylistically, it helped me. So, and the other thing I did, so the friend that I mentioned, the number two guy.
You got to say his name at this point.
Okay, I'll say times. Jeff. So Jeff.
Okay.
So my friend Jeff was a very tactical guy, a cheapo artist, you know, love tricks. In fact, so here's a sidetrack. So I don't know how long this, I may do too many sidetracks that the podcast will go on forever. But one of my last tournaments, or actually I think it was my last tournament, at one point in one of the games, I had a really bad position. And, you know, it was if I lost, it would, you know, put a damper on it, what had been a very good tournament. So one thing I did to kind of help motivate me, both, let's say, intellectually in the sense of looking for good moves, but also psychologically, is I decided to ask myself, what would Jeff do? And so I would just look for, you know, any trick I could, any tactical possibility. And if nothing else, it put me in a good mood. And, you know, I ended up saving the game too. So again, it gave me the right mindset for this. But anyway, so he's like this tactics lover and a better tactician, certainly at the time. I probably at my best, I became a better tactician than him. But certainly when we were all kind of growing up together, he was, you know, he's the tactical specialist. And then we had another friend named Daniel who... You mentioned that you might do a podcast with Ulf Andersen. Well, this guy was like our Ulf Andersen. Wow. So, you know, he would play these very quiet openings, just, you know, try to get some tiny advantage, and then just, you know, sits flash you to death and win in 80 moves. You know, that was his thing. And Jeff hated playing Daniel. Actually, most of those guys hated playing Daniel because, you know, these openings were slow. They were... you know, no tactics. And again, there's be these grinds against Fianchetto and double Fianchetto openings. Well, I can't say that I really enjoyed playing Daniel that much either, but I played him, and in part because he was such a pain in the neck to play. And so the result of all of this was that I became pretty good at all of these. So I wasn't as good an Ulf Andersen clone as Daniel was, but I was, you know, let's say 80%, 85%. And I wasn't as good a tactician and cheapo artist as Jeff was, but again, maybe 85%. And you know, I could do this with all the people in the group. So we had someone who might be like a proto Morozovich guy. And anyway, by being willing to play all these guys and embrace the suck, as they say in the military, of, you know, facing these unpleasant styles, I became able to kind of shapeshift against all of them. So when I play against Jeff, I just make it nice and boring, and he would self-destruct at some point because of that. And against Daniel, I could hang with his style well enough, but then when the tactics came, I would be better than him at that. So I think in addition to this kind of broad book learning, should be a better way of putting it. In addition to that, steeping myself in the history of the game, this willingness to, you know, play people who are difficult and to, you know, embrace in some sense all these different styles made me more adaptable, a little bit more universal. And I think that at the very least practically made me a stronger player than my peers.
It's like the fox and the hedgehog parable. You avoided specializing and were able to get better by having a wide range of skills.
Right. Although
I'm sure studying the games helped too. The classics.
Right. Although I would say I had preferences, so it's not that I'm, let's say, universal by nature, but rather I was just willing to, again, like I said, I didn't enjoy playing Daniel any more than those guys did.
Right.
But I was just more willing to do it. And I benefited from that.
And how, as someone who's still teaching chess, as you say, chess certainly has evolved since those days. Mm-hmm. How do you tie that together in terms of the advice you give to your students? Like the proverbial, I have an hour a day, how should I spend it question? Like what do you advise for people?
Right. Well, if you only have an hour a day, just do what you want to do with your hour. But I mean, to the extent that you can devote more time. I mean, I'd say one thing you should do is if you kind of get stuck when you plateau, you got to do something different. And in many cases, it's learning more chess, not more of the same chess, but more. So, you know, there are often these gaps, for instance. So I have a pretty strong adult student, and he never went through an E4, E5 phase as black. And so there's a whole bunch of positions where if his repertoire ends up getting him somewhere that's kind of like those positions, he plays it really cluelessly by comparison to his strength. I mean, the guy's been a master. He's a good expert, but he plays these positions much more weakly. And I think he would benefit greatly by diving into that world, maybe even, you know, taking 3 months and just studying that and playing it. Just play a bunch of blitz games, learn to play, again, E4, E5 is black, and switching your repertoire. So don't get caught up in saying, I'm a Magnus Carlsen or I'm a Mikhail Tal or something like that. Just, okay, you can play this kind of position pretty well for your rating. Okay, now go learn this. So, you know, being willing to switch, not thinking, not always being worried about, let's say, maximizing your current skill set. Okay, but developing other things, because not only does it give you more options, but also it will help you in the long run with even your current skill set. Like you'll know more about how to play the positions that you get into.
Okay.
As well as just, I think, being kind of useful to not get into ruts intellectually.
Yeah, that makes sense. And do you have a favorite player / favorite style?
Well, the funny thing is, so my two favorite players, at least for a long time, let's say for my formative years, are Tal.
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, is hardly original, and Petrosian.
Okay.
And yeah. I thought about this recently, and I think there is one thing that they both have in common. And the thing that they both have in common is that they do what they can to make their opponents irrelevant.
Interesting.
So for Tal, it was just, I'm going to just make this mess, and I don't care what you're doing. For Petrosian, it's, I'm going to dominate you to such an extent that you can't do a single thing on the chessboard. Right? So it's just, I mean, in some sense, I mean, you're trying to win a game, it's what you're doing, but it's the degree to which they're, again, not just trying to win, but just trying to make their opponents disappear, in some sense, by what they're doing. Right?
That's a great insight.
Yeah, so they're,
that's interesting.
Yeah, their opponents become irrelevant in two completely different ways, but they become irrelevant.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And do you feel like you've pulled that off in your game at your level?
On good days, sure. On good days, but of course, you know, there are notches ahead of me. By the way, I got to play Tal once in a simul, but I played him once, and that was interesting.
Yeah, how'd it go? Let's hear about it.
Well, okay. So there's a small backstory. So do you know who Kamran Shirazi is?
Yeah.
Okay. So Shirazi, for those of you who don't know, is an international master. He lives in France now. He was originally from Iran, and then he lived in the United States for a number of years. And I played him three times in the U.S. In tournaments. So I won the first two, lost the third. So the second game, I decided to play the modern against him. All right. So you all know what the modern is. And it was the modern with A6, not the modern with C6, which is kind of so I had met Alexi Root years before that. And she had taught me about this system. Because I guess that's in the Pacific Northwest. Everyone liked that. So I think Sierra One played it once upon a time. And it was, I think, Duncan Suttles, who was maybe the player who introduced it to the area. But again, it was kind of like that area's, you know, so Vancouver, Seattle, those guys, that was one of their sort of pet openings. So she told me about it, and I thought it was kind of interesting. So I started playing it every so often. And I played against Shirazi, and I won. And Shirazi, for those who don't know, he's like this, you know, kind of micro-tall. Sacrifices all over the place, plays crazy openings, loves complications, and tries to just, you know, bamboozle his opponents and win with tactics. So I played this against Shirazi in a tournament game, slow game, and I beat him. So I figured, okay, I'm gonna try this against Tal. And the thought is, of course, Tal is much stronger than Shirazi, but he has much less time than Shirazi. This idea did not work at all. So Tal just obliterated me, and I should have just learned from his, you know, games with people like Tringov and others who played the Pirates against him and got obliterated. It was not a scalable issue. So it was more just his intuition, his ability to know what's going on in these positions. It didn't matter for that in that context whether he had just seconds to think about it or minutes.
And do you still have the game?
I don't, unfortunately. So, yeah, when I had quit, I like threw out almost everything I had, which drives me nuts now.
Brian mentioned that too.
Yeah. So
yeah, that in particular is a bummer.
Yeah, it is.
You know, now when you run Tal through the engine, the engine just laughs. Right. So I'd like to see what it says about that game.
Actually, that's not entirely true. So if you look at Karoly's books on Tal, actually surprisingly he's more accurate than the kind of the caricature would have you think.
I don't know. In my sample, I guess I'm thinking mainly of games from the life and games of Mikhail Tal. But at least if you compare him to to someone like Petrosian, which of course is unfair because like the engines are going to like this style where you can't make a big mistake,
right?
Or it's harder to make a big mistake. So
right.
But anyway, in any event,
yeah. One thing is kind of funny. So the event where I played the silo where I played Tal, there's the guy's name is David Glicksman, or I think he goes by David Lucky now. So he had a video of this with him, and it shows a lot of the game with Tal going around, and it's just like, you know, it's every time it goes to his board, it shows. So I think I was like one board out of the camera for this video, so it's like nuts, you know. If it was just one more, maybe I could have reconstructed the game, but that didn't happen.
Oh, bummer. Yeah, I guess I can't think of a way that you'll get that game back.
No, sorry, I mean, Dennis. Yeah, I don't know if there's some sort of hypnosis where there's some memory where I could piece it together, but I'm sure it's gone.
Yeah. All right. Well, Dennis, I want to move to other topics, but just to wrap up your chess improvement advice, shake things up, change your routine. Are you an advocate of like doing lots of puzzles? I mean, it sounds like you're kind of, as an academic, you have more of a big picture approach. But
No. I think so. One of the things that I really believe, especially if you're not working with a coach, job number one is when you're up and coming until you're, I don't know, 1700 maybe. I used to say 1800. Ratings are a little bit different now, but tactics. So when I was a kid, I mean, this is sort of hyper nerdy, and I'm sure I didn't do it all the time, but I remember there would be these long bus rides in the morning, and most of the kids on the bus were sleeping, and I would be there with Reinfeldt's 1001 Brilliant Sacrifices and Combinations, just trying to see how much of this book I could go through each trip. And so, no, I mean, I did tactics, you know, like a maniac when I was a kid. And really, you want to be able to spot just ordinary tactics just instantly. I mean, if you can't do that, then it doesn't matter what kind of positions you get in the opening. You're generally just going to, it's going to fail. You're going to mess up somewhere. So, I mean, that's critical. And then, of course, you keep looking for harder tactics as you get stronger. But no, I think that's essential. I think that players who focus primarily on openings before, I mean, not to downplay openings, so you need to know something. But if you're doing openings before, if openings are your main focus before you're, let's say, 1700, 1800, rather than tactics, you're going astray.
Yeah, and I get that people get tired of hearing that, I think.
Yeah, well.
But the truth hurts, to quote Ben Feingold.
Right. There are better players than I am, but I mean, I'm 2400 doing it this way. If you're 2400 and you just studied openings and never did tactics, well, okay, you know, more power to you. But in general, the pattern is you got to master these basics. And again, it's not that you should never look at openings. Of course you should, but just that shouldn't be your first priority.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Well, Dennis, we need to take one more break to hear from our sponsors. And next up, I want to talk a bit about the U.S. Championship, which is coming soon. I've been playing a bit of Blitz lately, and whenever I'm active online, it's fun to go to aimchess.com and ask their almighty algorithm to give me some insights from my games. It scrapes the playing sites automatically and gives you actionable intel. In my case, the real takeaway this time was I got a 7% in resourcefulness in recent games. That's not very good. I need to get better at that. I need to fight harder when I'm losing in a Blitz game, look for tricks. And of course, Aim Chess, as it highlights various aspects of your game, strengths and weaknesses, shows you positions from the game so that you can practice, you can review tactics that you missed, and learn lots in a fun way when you review. So please check out aimchess.com. If you decide to subscribe, use the code perpetual30. You can also use the link in the show description to get the same discount, 30% off, at aimchess.com.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
And we are back. And Dennis, if no earth-shattering chess events push you back, this podcast will come out on October 4th, which is also the day the U.S. Championship is slated to start. Now, I'm not particularly provincial when it comes to chess, but I find this tournament particularly interesting, particularly because of the entries who are not really from the U.S.
Right, right.
But first and foremost, will you be covering this on the Chess Mine?
Yes, I will. So, and for the same reason, or I would say the same thing, that I'm not particularly provincial either. There are plenty of American events that I ignore, but the U.S. Championship is basically a super GM event nowadays, so I cover it.
Yeah, and I did manage to chase down who the field will be. It appears from what I have read online that Nakamura will not be playing, which was the main thing that I think was a bit up in the air. So for the open section of the U.S. closed championship. So what that means is men and women are theoretically allowed. The participants are Aronian, Caruana, So, Dominguez, Shanklin, Jeffrey Zhang, Hans Niemann, Sam Sevian, Ray Robson, Darius Swerts, Awunder Liang, Christopher Yu, Elshin Moradi, and Alex Lenderman.
Okay.
Now, out of those players, Dennis, is there anyone you're particularly interested to see?
Well, it'll certainly be interesting for other reasons to see what happens with you-know-who.
Yeah, with Mr. Niemann.
That's right. But, I mean, I always have a little bit of fondness for Wonder because I played him once. So, and that was a good hard-fought draw back when he was, I think, 2 years old or something. No, he was 10 or 11. Right. Seems like he was two. I mean, Caruana's really come on hard times the last year or so. I mean, I don't know what's happened there, but so before, I mean, certainly he would have been the favorite and in one sense the most interesting player, I always like watching So. I mean, he doesn't have this really flashy style, but he's just so amazingly consistent. So that's always fun as well. And, you know, Dominguez too. I'm surprised. I mean, I always expect him to have some breakout tournament. And he has a very, very appealing style as well and plays a lot of sharp openings. So, you know, all these, the three big guys that are there. Am I forgetting somebody? Those are, right, like the three 2750 plus guys. Or is there another? It's just
not right. Aronian.
Oh, and Aronian, of course. Yeah, and Aronian is always, actually, Aronian, I would say, is the most entertaining player out of those four, to be sure. Although, yeah, so I would still probably make So a small favorite at this point out of that, but it's such a small favorite that it's...
Yeah, So seems like he has the highest floor, at least.
Right.
Although Dominguez has a high floor, too.
Right.
But Aronian and Caruana are higher highs but lower lows. And I'm interested, you know, I feel like, I mean, of course, the Neiman storyline, and he's ascending so quickly that obviously
right. He
could win it. But also, you know, Jeffrey Zhang, Sam Sevian, Ray Robson, mm-hmm. I feel like those three guys are so strong, and this is a good stage for them. So it'd be nice to see any or all of them step up.
Right. I mean, absolutely. It's a chance for them to break out. I mean, it's, you know, if they win that, then they kind of, they'll probably get their year of invitations. The way Neiman is, or the way Shanklin did last year, and so on.
Yeah, it's tough at the top. I mean,
it really is. I'm surprised we haven't imported any new GMs, you know, in the last 5 weeks or anything.
What's your? So I saw that when the Olympiad was going on. Obviously, you were blogging about it, and as I alluded to, I'm more as a global chess fan. I'm following it, especially now. I have to say, I you know, I'm a big Aronian fan, mm-hmm. but I don't think of him as an American player.
Right.
But it seemed like you were rooting for the U.S. in the Olympiad. Is that fair?
I would say in a general way, but actually, I was very quickly much more enthusiastic about India too and Uzbekistan.
Yeah.
As a chess fan. So, yeah. And of course, I wanted the United States to do well, but chess-wise, no. I was actually, I mean, again, very quickly, I mean, I think it was like round three or four. I mean, I was already, okay, yeah, maybe the U.S., but no, these two teams, especially India too, I thought they were going to win, and came within, you know, just Gukesh steaming, you know, if he didn't just blow up in the game with Abdusadarov, they would have won. So, that was an amazing thing. And yeah, the U.S. just didn't play well, and it was disappointing that Nakamura didn't play. I mean, I guess the issue was that he would be board five, or at least at the time they were making the pairings, and he didn't want to be that low. Okay, I understand, but same time, you know, it's the Olympiad. Better to represent your country. I mean, think of Fischer. So Fischer in the USSR versus the world match, where Larsen, you know, said, "Oh, I should be board one," even though. Well, there weren't ratings, but I mean, clearly the lifetime record was in Fischer's favor, both, I think, head-to-head and also in terms of performance. But Larsen had a couple of good years while Fischer was not playing. And Fischer, to everyone's surprise, said, okay, I'll play board two. And it worked out. And they both beat their opponents. So it would have been nice if Nakamura had done that. But
yeah, and of course, it would be nice to have him in the U.S. championship
absolutely,
as well.
Yeah. Especially with him having played so well, I mean.
Yeah. And, you know, he was quick to point out that he wasn't retired around the time of the candidates, but now we have to wonder when we'll get to see him play again.
Right.
At least in a classical setting. Although, I get it. He's got a good gig.
He does, but, you know, it won't go away. People have loved watching him play online even before streaming since he was a little tyke. I mean, I remember when he was 10 years old, he was already a terror on ICC back then. When ICC was, you know, the server.
Yeah, those were the days.
Yeah.
The Internet Chess Club is still going strong, still exists at least.
Yep.
All right, well, Dennis, as we look towards wrapping up, we have two questions from people I believe you know,
okay. Related
to your own illustrious career. First one is from a Patreon supporter and friend of the pod, John Fernandez.
Oh.
And John says... Ask him to tell you about his immortal pawn. Or no, sorry, wrong question. we're getting to the immortal pawn game. Right. John's question is, how does it feel to have played the most amazing chess game of all time, Monocrucis Baccarola Parsippany 1999, which we have to, I looked at the game, but we have to give context for listeners.
Yeah. So this is, I'm glad he knows that game. Right. John is, yeah, he's a good guy. And, one cool thing. Yeah. He was there when I played the other game, the Udasin game too. And okay. So like the picture, if you see the picture of me, that is, if you have Chessbase and you pull up one of my games, there's a picture. So that was taken by Fernandez after the Udasin game. So there you go. So there's a little,
we'll get to the Udasin game,
but just cause you mentioned John Fernandez.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
So the Baccarola games, this was in the amateur team, I don't know, 98 or 99. And I was on a strong team. I mean, we were, our average rating was like 2190 something. And this was, I think, in round two. And so I'm playing this guy, Lou Barcarola. He's 2170 or something. I was 2409, I think, at the time. And the game, so like e4, e5, knight f3, knight c6. And for some reason, I played knight c3, d6, d4, bishop g4. And I played d5, he played knight to d4. So my knight on f3 is pinned by the bishop on g4. And I was originally going to play bishop to e3, I think. And then I started thinking, well, what about knight takes d4? This could be interesting. And
so this is a queen sacrifice for listeners.
Right. So I'm giving up my queen for two pieces, a couple of checks. So, but it's no good. But I'm looking at it. It's interesting. And the more I'm thinking about it, the more I'm kind of talking myself into this. And it's completely irresponsible because, you know, I'm board one on my team. It's a team tournament. It's not
right.
It's not me just, you know, being a goofball on my own. And but the thing is, the more I thought about it, the more I just I've got to do this. You know, I'll how often do you get the chance to do this? And so I played knight takes d4. And the remarkable thing is, like, I had to keep finding new ways of keeping the initiative going in this game. So I'm sacking pawns, sacking the exchange, and like at some point I sack another piece and a rook. And it just goes on and on. And so, you know, and this guy's playing great. He's defending. He's, you know, not maybe playing perfectly, but playing really well and keeps neutralizing all of my, you know, every new bit of the bag of tricks a la Mikhail Tal I come up with. He's got an answer. He's got an answer. And he's also getting in really big time trouble. And he survives that too. So, and in the meantime, I've managed to promote a pawn. So it's a queen ending. But I'm down, I think, three pawns or something like this. And the team situation is it's 1.5 to 1.5 at this point. So, you know, we're up 2-1. We're up 2-1. But, I mean, if I lose, it's a tied match. So, you know, so he's made the time control by, you know, with just seconds to spare. And, you know, the team's outside waiting. You know, they want to go to dinner. I said, well, you know, just it's not going to be long. And, you know, I make one more sack. I make a pawn sack. And so I have a queen and a pawn. He's got a queen and four pawns at this point, three or four pawns. So I play b3, b4, and he takes it. And I think he saw that there was a stalemate idea, but I think he saw the wrong stalemate idea. Because the wrong stalemate idea, he has a way to get out. But the right stalemate idea, which of course I had in mind, and it's kind of an unusual one, so it's not with my king in the corner. It's with my king, I think, is on e8. And so I play, like, his king's on g6. I have a queen on d5, and he's got his queen on, I think, c7. So I played b4. He took my last pawn with a pawn, and I played queen to d6 check. So he has to take my queen, otherwise I take his queen and I win. But queen takes, and it's stalemate. So his queen's on d6, king's on g6, my king's on e8. And so it was amazing. So I sacrificed two queens in the game, and I sacrificed a rook. I sacked an exchange and a bunch of other miscellaneous other things, too. And the poor guy, because, I mean, again, he defended so well and survived the tricks and time trouble and all of that. And then, like, my last trick, he falls for.
Yeah, that's funny, because I looked at the game. It was in Chessbase, in my Chessbase, so I looked at it today, and it didn't have your opponent's reading. And I was thinking, like, this guy played pretty well, considering the circumstances.
Right.
And one question I have for you. So, okay, you played this sacrifice. You sacrificed your queen on move 5. The engine gives it like a -3 or something which actually is not a disaster, you know, for a queen sack. Did you feel like it's probably unsound? Like, were you like totally out of book? And did you feel like it's probably unsound? Or like, what was your mindset?
So, no, this had nothing to do with book. Like, I played knight to c3 because I had chatted with Fedorowicz at one point. He thought, oh, you should try the Scotch Four Knights. So I was going to try a Scotch Four Knights in this tournament. But the guy didn't play knight c6 on move three. So I had no idea what was going on there. After his third move, it was just me playing chess at the board.
Sorry for the variations, listeners. Yeah. We'll keep this quick. But you knew you were going to play bishop g5 check and king.
I saw something. I mean, it wasn't.
Okay. Yeah, but I knew you his king on the run.
I knew his king was getting f6, and I'm getting some checks. And I maybe even saw the h4, h6, bishop g5 check idea.
Right, yeah.
Right.
Okay. So yeah, fascinating game, and I'll link to it for listeners to check it out. Thanks for bearing with us, those of you still listening. Now, next story is legendary grandmaster here in the U.S. used to rack up tournament win after tournament win, Leonard Udasin, and you had a really beautiful win. This beautiful mass of pawns gathered in the center of the board. And Brian Caron said that you have a story to go along with that victory as well.
Right. Well, speaking of Brian, I had left New York the year before. So I was living in Indiana. I was doing a fellowship at Notre Dame. Still trying to finish this this dissertation, that didn't actually finish. But I was there. I was back in New York for a few weeks during the summer because Brian had invited me to do a chess camp with him out on Long Island. And so I knew about this New York Masters tournament that Greg Shahadi was running each week, whatever it was, on Tuesday or Wednesday, maybe Thursday. I don't remember what day of the week it was. But so he was running it, and these were cool. I mean, I would watch these events every week on ICC and see these guys. And as you said, Udasin would just rack up wins all the time there. I mean, he was just completely dominating. And Udasin, I mean, he was, I think, also a two-time candidate. He was a little bit past his peak years in 2002 when I played him, but still very strong. And anyway, so I was watching these, and so I decided, well, I took the train in from Long Island to Manhattan to go and watch this in person. And I mean, I'm exhausted. It was like, you know, summer, it's July, it's, you know, it's hot, I'm sweating. And again, I just wanted to kind of watch for an hour or two and then go back out. But Greg Shahadi said, oh, you know, hey, Dennis, we've got an odd number of players. Would you be willing to play a filler game? And I didn't really want to, but, you know, he twisted my arm, and I decided, okay, I'll play. And then, oh, and guess what? You're playing Udasin on board one, you know, congratulations. And so at first, you know, I thought, oh, come on. And then I realized, well, no, this is a cool opportunity. I've got nothing to lose. So let's just enjoy it and have fun. And I did. So it was a Schliemann. I played with black in the game. And I think at first I was okay, but I kind of got into a little bit of positional trouble. And my solution to this was to sacrifice a piece for a couple of pawns. And there were a couple of ways he could have taken it. One way would have been better, but the way he did it, I got this giant center, this enormous mass of pawns in the center of the board. And the computer is not thrilled with my sacrifice, but practically it was very good. I mean, this guy is, you know, 2600 GM, and he couldn't figure out what to do with it. In fact, I was just making progress through the game as it went on with this, again, massive pawn center. And as the game goes on, and we're both getting into time trouble, these pawns are just slowly marching up the board. And finally, at one point, I sacrificed another exchange. So I'm down a rook for, I don't know, two, three pawns, but at one point near the end of the game, I've got pawns on e2, d2, and c2, and then another pawn, I think, on d3 as well. Maybe I'm misremembering exactly, but I think that's more or less right. So I have three pawns on the seventh rank, second rank of the board, and then one pawn just behind it. And there's nothing he can do about it at a certain point. They're just too far advanced. Then I queen the pawn, and I mated him a couple of moves later in the middle of the board. So
yeah, just a fun game. I definitely like, you know, I often say I'll put the game in the show description and listeners should play through it, but I emphasize it for this one. Mildly reminiscent of Gufeld Kowalik with the pawns just rolling through the center, and sacrifice after sacrifice, at least as the game progressed. Yeah. But I couldn't even tell when I played through the game, because initially it didn't look that imposing for you. I was like, did he even sacrifice a piece or did he just blunder it?
Right. No, it was a sack. It was a sack. Okay. No, because if I didn't make the sack, I was worried that he was just going to get this death grip on the F5 square. He was going to plant a knight on F5 and I would just suffocate with this, with that piece there. So that's why I sacrificed the piece.
Okay, fun stuff. And last thing, possibly, Dennis, I want to hear a little more about attending this World Championship in 2007 in Mexico City.
Yeah, no, it was a really really pleasant experience. It was not that well attended. I was a little disappointed by that, but it was just fun to hang out in the press room. So a good friend of mine, who's a chess player, Alex Herrera, not a master, although actually in correspondence chess, I think he is a pretty good master in that discipline. But yeah, we're good friends for many years, and we both had a little time. So we spend about a week. We were there for, I would say, about half the event that Anand won. So that was when, again, this is kind of part of this whole transition from the split era to the unified title. So Anand won this with, I think, Kramnik and Svidler, or no, Kramnik and Gelfand tying for second, and then you had the Anand-Kramnik match the next year that Anand won, and then that was the end of all of the... Actually, there was still the Anand-Topalov, right? So Topalov had the match with Kamsky. Anyway, Mexico City 2007 was a lot of fun. So, you know, you had the playing hall, and that we really didn't have access to, but I would basically hang out in the press room with... I'm trying to remember the grandmaster's name, but it was just a lot of fun. So we just analyzed for hours there. Frederick Friedel was there, so he was kind of fun to talk to, and yeah. Had some field trips to go see the pyramids one of the days. So it was just a really nice time.
Yeah, and that tournament, I mean, Kramnik, Anand, Svidler, Morozevich, Lecoq, Gelfand, a young Aronian,
right,
and a young Grishuk, quite a lineup.
Yeah.
So you say you didn't go to the hall. Did you see those guys around much?
Actually, yeah. So I have in the other room, it's not a video podcast, but I don't know, maybe you can take a picture of it or something. I have a chessboard that I got all of them to sign.
Oh, that's fun.
And Morozevich, being the unusual player he is, was about to sign on one of the dark squares, so it wouldn't be readable. But,
right,
but they kind of realized, oh no, I got to sign on a light square.
That's funny. Okay. And any other stories like that, Dennis, before we wrap up here?
Well, I also went to the 95 World Championship at the World Trade Center. So I went to about five or six of those games. And I can hardly recommend that. So even when I was a kid, barely playing in tournaments, So I grew up in Las Vegas, but I would often go and play in these Southern California tournaments. But what I would often do is after my game had finished, I would actually be one of the wall board, you know.
Oh, yeah, I did a few
that.
Of those.
Yeah. And that was just always a really nice thing. So whenever you get a chance to just watch in person top players playing and to kind of be able to hang around grandmasters when they're analyzing for each other, right, not just doing it for a general audience. It's just a really cool experience. So, you know, if you're playing in a big tournament and you see a couple, you know, like a grandmaster doing a postmortem, you know, see if you can kind of sneak over there and, you know, unobtrusively catch what they're doing. Because I think it rubs off on you, and it's part of the joy of the game that it's not just, you know, they're not selling you something. It's not packaged material. It's just you get to see them being themselves, just, you know, not kind of holding back. Oh, I should say one more thing about the Mexico City thing. So Kramnik and Gelfand, so that they had drawn a game, and before they went, so I would attend the press conferences, and but before they did it, in this case, they had a little postmortem. So there was like a board to the side in the press room, and they were analyzing. And it was savage. Not in terms of like them arguing with each other, but just the speed with which they were blasting variations out. I mean, it was incredible. And so there you get to see, you know, what's going on. So it's not them, again, trying to speak to a general audience. I mean, that's great. I'm glad they do that. But it's really cool to see these guys in their element, what they're capable of. Oh, along those lines, I got to tell you one more chess story.
Sure.
So I mentioned Shirazi earlier. So the first tournament where I think I scored against titled players. No, I think I'd drawn, but like, this is the first time I beat an IM. And so I beat Shirazi, and I just actually blew him off the board. And what's weird about this, so I had a graveyard job, graveyard shift job in Las Vegas. So I'd worked that job, drove to California, 4 hours away, played in this tournament. First round, blow Shirazi off the board. Round two, I'm playing Larry Christensen near his PQs. Jeez. And yeah, we draw this crazy game. And so I'm thinking, here I am. It's the next level of my career. I'm moving up in the world. I'm one of the big boys, or on my way to being one of the big boys. And then I had a postmortem with Christensen. And he's showing me variation after variation that I did not see. And at a certain point, now, of course, it was a crazy game, and that's his specialty. I mean, that's where he's great. I mean, he's just an amazing, you know, super imaginative tactician. But we're looking at all these variations, and I'm not seeing this one, I'm not seeing that one, and I had no concept of a bunch of them. And at a certain point, I'm thinking, it's just not fair that I drew with this guy. How is this possible that I drew, you know, and he saw all these cool things. Now, I got stronger since then, but still, I mean, you know, I have no doubt that if I had the same, you know, kind of experience with let's say Kramnik or, you know, some other top guy, and they would show me just endless variations that I didn't see. And, you know, it's just remarkable what these guys can do. And, yeah, and we don't really get to see it.
Well, we see it a little more than we used to now in the digital age, the streaming age, but yeah.
Right. But yeah, we see it more, but not as much. But like I said, that was, again, just really kind of remarkable watching that Kramnik-Gelfand postmortem, where it's like...
Yeah, and it's also, I think they dumb it down for us.
Yeah, no, but this was just them. So that's what I'm saying. Exactly. No one was like part of this, but you get to see them like moving pieces really quickly. And, you know, like just set it back up, boom, 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 set it up, you know. And what was kind of cool is like they did this for about 4 or 5 minutes. And then it was just like they both sort of simultaneously recognized, okay, it's done. And now they walk up for the conference and then give us, you know, the baby talk.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. In one of my interviews with Ben Feingold, and he's told this story many times, he was at a tournament where Kasparov and Karpov played, and he figured out where they were going to have to sit for the postmortem, and he like went and sat there and waited, and then described a similar scenario where he was just like, my goodness, these guys are just on a whole nother level when he watched them actually analyze. All right. Well, Dennis, this has been great. You've told some great stories, given some great chess advice. Any closing words before we say our goodbyes?
Okay, I can throw in a plug for Ashland University.
Yeah, of course. Don't worry. I was going to do that,
too. So,
but go ahead.
So I'm the chess coach there. So if you're in or near Central Ohio and Ashland University is somewhere on your radar of schools, we are offering some scholarship money for chess. So if you're a chess player and you're interested, by all means, contact me about that. We might be able to do something.
We get some chess parents listening too.
Yeah, so absolutely.
Take note, chess
right.
parents. Yeah.
And of course, I give lessons and I blog and all that. But and I would just say you did a great job. So nice interviewing there. So
thank you. Appreciate
you
it.
Seem to
it's been
the
a
right
lot
man
of fun.
For the job. So you said there was a need, and you know, the need is in large part filled because you know what you're doing. So. Very good.
Thanks. I appreciate it. And again, the blog is called Chess Mind. And listeners, as we were saying, you can just get it. You sign up for free and it's just emailed to you when you have a new post, and then read it or don't. And while you're at it, you might want to sign up for the Perpetual Chess Link Fest as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. And there's two blogs. So it's the Substack one, the chessmind.substack.com, because the other one is still up for now. But
right. Yeah, that's a good point. And I'll also link to it front and center in the notes for the show, so listeners can just click through, as well as the couple of games that we discussed. So thanks a lot, Dennis. I will be reading you as always. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Thanks to everyone who helps make Perpetual Chess possible. Big shout out to my producer, Matthew Passy. I'd also like to thank the Blue Wire Podcast Network, with whom we are proud to be affiliated. Be sure to follow us on social media, BennyFishel1 on Twitter, at Perpetual Chess on Instagram, or you can join the Perpetual Chess Facebook group. You can email me, ben@perpetualchesspod.com. And of course, last but not least, I'd like to give major thanks to the Perpetual Chess Patreon and PayPal supporters. Those who choose to join that community based on their level of support can do things like submit questions for guests of the show, have access to live Zoom Q&A lectures with grandmasters who often have appeared on the show, going over chess games, answering questions, stuff like that. And you can even get access to ad-free Perpetual Chess if that's your preference. So, but most of all, thanks to everyone for listening, and we will catch you all on the next episode. Thank you.
Social Podcast Network.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.